Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today it's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Morning, Mark.
Good morning.
So songbirds are pretty much wrapping up their breeding season, right? But there are some exceptions, a few late breeders.
Yeah, right. We're at that period where a lot of the local breeding birds are pretty well done. They're tending their fledged young. That's what's happening in my yard. We've got mixed flock of like chickadee and titmouse families and downy woodpecker families. And you know, a lot of these will be done for the year once they've raised their kids. You know, they're like, I'm done.
I'm done.
No more
empty
kids.
Empty nest.
Their husband's like, don't even look at that baby. We're not having any more. but others just keep going, and it depends on if they haven't been successful. You know, a lot of nests fail. The blue jays, the crows, the raccoons get them, and they keep trying. And so you might end up seeing a brood of like pretty recently fledged cardinals in September. So it does continue all through the summer, but it's just different now in that a lot of them are done. You know, the oriole chicks are all out of the nests and kind of roving around, and we're in that dopey young bird period more so than a nest and nestling period.
Right.
And so, you just hear them everywhere, and they sound a little different, and they're needy, and you know how kids are.
Exactly. Loud. And if you've got something happening in your yard, let us know. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right. What about water birds?
Yeah. So everything is, all of the late summer fun is beginning right now. And so June is a lull period. And I talked about in the bird report last week, people will show up on the Cape and they'll reach out to Audubon. Where are all the gulls? And they're remembering some other visit when there were lots of gulls on the beach, or must've been later in the summer, whatever. And in June, everything is breeding somewhere else or somewhere where you're not, right? And so the gulls are on North Monomoy or, you know, Penikese or just places that are out of the way, islands. The terns are in big colonies on the islands for the most part, except for least terns nest on local beaches. The shorebirds are all up in the Arctic. All the shorebirds that we see in late summer coming through, all the semi-palmated sandpipers and semi-palmated plovers and dowagers and all that stuff, they're all up in the Arctic breeding during June. The local birds are kind of quiet. So it is a lull, right? It's like the slack tide. And now the tide is coming south again. And not just south, but it's all directions. It's sort of an all directions tide, because the wading birds that were breeding in colonies on Monomoy and on the North Shore and south of us are dispersing from the colony. So now we're seeing more egrets, more great blue herons, some of the uncommon ones, night herons. Everybody's dispersing. And so that's true of, and the gulls, the terns, they're going to start dispersing away from the colonies and start staging on beaches. And, you know, don't worry, they'll be there to steal your sandwich.
I was going to say, it's kind of nice not having them swoop down to steal your food, right?
I know, you don't really miss the gulls that harass you at the beach.
Yeah.
My daughter always filled that role, my little Phoebe. I always called her the seagull. She would just like walk up to people and like take a sandwich from a kid. Or just like ask for food from random families. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, that's my seagull.
This poor kid doesn't have enough food.
Yeah, we do feed her. But the gulls will be back. And this just builds throughout the summer, right? The seabird numbers offshore build, the water bird numbers, the shorebird numbers. So the adult shorebirds are finishing up their nests up in Arctic tundra, Arctic mountain slopes, and all the remote places that they nest, and starting to come down here. You know, least sandpipers have been showing up, semi-palmated sandpipers, some dowitchers, greater yellow legs. So some of the common shorebirds have already been showing up. Somebody had a whimbrel at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary in the last couple of days. One of my favorites. It's one of the best places to see whimbrels is at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary. Just a big crazy sandpiper with a long curved bill. eat fiddler crabs like popcorn. And we have 8 bazillion, scientifically speaking, fiddler crabs at Wellfleet Bay. And so we
It's a
tend to
good
do well
spot.
with Wimbrels. So yeah, all of that stuff, the lull is over, and numbers of all of those fun water birds and shorebirds will be building. And then by the end of the summer, you'll get like flocks of, I've had the experience of going to Fort Hill in Eastham and counting like 80 great egrets, just like scanning from up top, scanning through the marsh. And so it's a good time to be on the Cape now, because you missed the lull, and now everything is coming back, and will be increasing throughout the summer.
And of course, the summer seabird season is very exciting if you're out on one of the whale watches, right? Because then you can also see some of the pelagic birds.
Yes, and I've been clicking around. I've been trying to figure out what people are seeing on the boats, and it doesn't seem like anybody is seeing tons of shearwaters, but there's the possibility. The best way, unless you hoof it out to Race Point in Provincetown, where people have been getting all the shearwaters and sometimes Wilson storm petrels, the best way to get these seabirds that we have in the summer that come from really all points on the globe to feed in these really rich waters of Stellwagen Bank and east of Chatham, places like that, is to go on a whale watch. And then, the whales, yep.
Yeah, we do love the whales, but hey, it's
Yeah,
like
come.
a double show, right?
Right. Come for the whales, stay for the seabirds. And if you are interested in birds, let the naturalists know, because otherwise they'll ignore them. I mean, not necessarily, if Dennis Minsky's the naturalist, he won't ignore the birds,
I don't think
John
he. I don't
Conlon.
think it's in his DNA to ignore the birds.
No, you can't ignore the birds.
Yeah,
They're
exactly.
just an important part of the system out there. And oftentimes they're feeding with the whales. But you could see great shearwaters, Cory shearwaters, Sooty shearwaters, Manx shearwaters, all coming from different places, right? The Manx shearwaters came from the North Atlantic. The Sooty shearwaters came from the South Atlantic. You could see Sooty shearwaters off New Zealand.
Wow.
The great shearwaters came from the South Atlantic down towards Antarctica. The Cory shearwaters came from the Mediterranean, potentially, or the Azores, or so it's just amazing that they're descending upon this, just kind of like everybody else. Everybody's descending on the Cape from
Cape Cod,
all
the
parts of the
place
globe
to
right now.
be. Yeah,
The
right.
traffic on the ocean is terrible right now. And then the Wilson storm petrels also coming from down near Antarctica. Just a quick Wilson storm petrel, if you don't know what that is, they're little, kind of swallow-like brown birds with a white rump, and so they patter along the surface of the ocean, and they eat like small crustaceans, kind of planktonic things. They look for slicks of oil on the water from sea creatures, and sometimes they form big flocks. And there are millions of them, and they come from nesting islands down towards Antarctica, come up here for their winter, like the Sooty shearwaters and the great shearwaters. But they're little, and someone sent us a video, someone from this boat, the Albatross, in Sisuit Harbor. And Dennis, Mass Audubon, runs these marine life cruises on, and the captain's like, "What is this thing?" And it's a Wilson storm petrel on this glass calm Cape Cod Bay all by itself, and it's just jumping on the water. It's like something from a cartoon. They're like, "What is this Jesus bird?" It's walking on the water, and they've got their wings out, and they're fluttering just enough that they can hop along the surface of the water on their funny little yellow webbed feet.
Wow.
And they're the size of a robin, a little bigger,
Fun
maybe,
to
but they don't
watch.
look it. On the against the giant ocean, they look tiny, and they just hop, hop, hop along,
Yeah.
pattering, pattering, looking for things on the surface they can pick off. So, yeah,
Yeah,
keep an eye out
keep
for a
an eye for
Wilson
those.
storm petrel, and think about how far that little thing came to get here when you see it. Just
Amazing.
maintain that sense of wonder.
Yeah, you mentioned a Race Point and a couple of cool sightings out there. Somebody saw a puffin fly by, right? Brown
Oh, yeah.
booby, brown, and also brown.
Yeah.
So you never, that's the thing about Race Point. You never know what you're going to see if you're,
No,
it's
no. I,
worth a hike out there.
right. Right. A turn from Eastern Europe. You never know exactly right what's going to just land on that beach or fly by. And so, yeah, puffins are not really a thing on Cape Cod. You can't go anywhere and ever expect to see a puffin. Even in a storm, like a fall nor'easter, when you're at first encounter, you might fly by, and even if you were there, you'll miss it. Like, oh, someone two cars down said they just saw a puffin fly by and they got a photo. Oh, and so that's kind of puffin sightings here. And so this guy Ted Bradford, who's a birder who spends a lot of time out at Race Point, along there's a few birders who just spend hours and hours at Race Point. And when you put in that much time, they're the ones that find the cool stuff. Like Peter Flood. Peter Flood found that brown booby, Blair Nicola. They're out there all the time. And so, yeah, so there was a brown booby out there, which came from the Caribbean, and there was a puffin. Like in the same day,
Right.
the puffin, came from Maine or
Maine, yeah.
Canada, whatever, Scotland, just North Atlantic nesting colony. And then there you look over there, and there's a brown booby that came up from St. Thomas or whatever. And so it's again, it's that idea of this is where everything wants to be, from people from New York to birds from the southern and northern oceans.
Right. And for people who aren't all that familiar with what some of the birds might be, people like Blair, the hardcore birders, they're happy to share their info. If you often say, "Hey, what are you seeing?" they'll tell you what they're seeing and even point things out for you.
Yeah,
Yeah.
sometimes that's true.
Yeah, some, no, I think it's true most of the time.
Sometimes they'll ignore you. Yeah, it depends on the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, most birders would love to show you. Yeah,
Yeah.
it at a certain point you're out there, but what are you looking at? Anything good?
Oh
You hear that
yeah.
question enough times that
Yeah,
you
I
kind
can
of like at after a while you're avoiding eye contact. But yeah, for the most part, yeah, people would be happy to show you what they're looking at.
Yeah. We got an email from Carol who says, "Once again this year, I'm enjoying the oriole and catbird action on my jelly feeder. It appears that the first brood is about ready to graduate from finishing school. The catbirds are especially funny and loquacious, reminding me that more groceries are in order and hanging around nearby as I spoon out their drug of choice. But I notice that the birds sometimes ignore a large lump of jelly in favor of what looks like licking some from the surface. This can't be easy as the jelly is on an unfinished cedar shingle. They appear to lay their heads sideways, not stick out the tongue to the front. Maybe they're not licking at all." Sibley doesn't have much to say on the subject of tongues. Certainly, woodpeckers and hummingbirds are experts with theirs, but is it common for other species to feed that way?
It's a
Complicated
good question.
question.
It's a good question about catbirds, but some of these species, like catbirds that spend the winter in Central America, where nectar can be a good food source, have that ability to, and they can drink water. So, yeah, it's a good question about what they're doing with the jelly. I haven't watched it on that kind of micro level. But yeah, things like orioles, black-throated blue warbler, there are species that will go down and will Cape May warblers and can drink nectar. You only think of hummingbirds really doing that, but there are some songbirds that are able to take advantage of that, particularly when they're down in Central America for the winter, where we wouldn't see it. And catbirds are probably no different. They're sort of successful generalists, and yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. But yeah, I can't speak to exactly what they're doing on your cedar shingle.
Right, and surprising that they don't go for the big lump, the easy score, right?
Yeah, I right. I don't know what's happening there.
Yeah.
But yeah, normally they would just take beakfuls, right?
Yeah. Yeah. All
I don't know.
right.
They're just
Well,
going. Maybe it's more. There's more sugar in the liquidy part they're going
maybe.
for. Yeah.
Yeah. But Carol's very observant.
Yes.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday. 866-999-4626 is our number for your bird questions, stories, or comments. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Stephen is giving us a call from Dennis. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Mindy. So glad I flipped on the radio. I've had a bird question for months.
Great.
Love your show. And so in East Dennis, Blackball Hill, Dennis Village, plenty of hummingbirds as normal. My girlfriend lives down in Eastham, just off the highway near the salt pond. She's a huge birder, flower person, very vigilant, not a single hummingbird all season. and she has friends in Northeast Am, everywhere from the ocean to the bay, and none of us have seen a hummingbird down here. And I wondered if that's the general observation.
I don't know. I haven't heard anything like that. And it's always funny. It's such a common thing to these localized, you know, where are my songbirds? Where are my hummingbirds? You know, I don't get ton. I never get tons of them that I know of in my yard. I have the hummingbird feeder out.
Yeah.
And flowers for them. I do see them. And there's a male been coming and I see female. I don't know how many different, you never know how many different birds are involved because there's different ones from different nesting areas kind of cycling through your feeder. But not having any at all. And, you know, the usual, well, did you change out the nectar and did you use the right recipe? God. I don't have an answer for it. I have not gotten other reports of no hummingbirds, but now we have one.
We've been doing it for years.
What's
that? We've been doing it for years. We've been doing it for years, and she's got all sorts of other feeders, and maybe No, and Dennis, we've got 10 feeders right on top of each other, and a little hummingbird comes in all the time.
Yeah.
Is it in the shade? Is there too much sun? We are, besides ourselves, plenty of flowers that they might be attracted to, but we've not seen a single one.
And I wonder if it could be maybe there's more flowers and feeders in the neighborhood and the hummingbirds are there. Although you said somebody
possible,
else. Is,
but,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Several neighbors, same thing. And we know to look at the flowers as well. They might prefer that.
So. Well, you know, it's interesting because I had something similar. Usually I just recently saw my first hummingbird in my yard. I'm not out there all the time. So, you know, they could have been there. But now that I have some of the red flowers in bloom, I've noticed every day.
Sure.
Yeah.
What do you have, Crocosmia or
yes,
something?
Yes, I love that. Yeah, and it's just coming in bloom now, and it's absolutely gorgeous. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe there's like a big. I feel like I saw a bunch of Crocosmia in East Ham somewhere just like yesterday or something. They love that. So there might just if are you saying that's been true the whole season? Like they didn't get them in mid May. They didn't get them in June.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And we've
been
on the lookout, and not a single one.
Yeah. So
that's
odd.
Very strange. Yeah. Usually you hang a feeder and there they are.
Got
and they're
every
not
pick- other.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're not picky about sun and shade.
Kind of
and
you can imagine.
Yeah.
Well,
no,
duly noted.
All right, Stephen, we'll keep our ear out in case anybody else has that same observation. Thanks for calling. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, swallow-tailed and Mississippi kites still hanging around.
Yeah, good Lord. What a bizarre, just incredible story that has been really ongoing for several years and has just kind of come to a head this year. The only thing we're missing is like a smoking gun, like an active nest that somebody actually sees the nest and incubation and feeding chicks and that kind of thing. We're still kind of nibbling at the idea that they're definitively nesting. But just to back up, so swallowtail kites and Mississippi kites are birds of mostly the deep south, and really deep south, like South America to a large extent, when you're talking about both species in the winter and then swallowtail kites. Your average swallowtailed kite in the world never leaves South America. But it's a species that it's a hawk with long pointed wings and a long pointed black tail. Like it looks like a barn swallow. They look like a gigantic barn swallow, basically. Pointy in all directions, a little tiny beak. They spend all their time on the wing, black and white, incredibly graceful. One of the most graceful flying birds in the world. It's just an absolute joy to watch. And you normally just, you wouldn't see them north of South Carolina, really. Florida mainly is where you would see breeding swallowtail kites. And Mississippi kites are across the southern belt of states. It's another small hawk. And both of them, like to eat insects on the wing is a big part of their diet, which is kind of why they're so graceful, such good flyers. And so we have the cicadas this year that have fed into the story, no pun intended. But so there have been sightings of swallowtail kites consistently in the Mid-Cape area, an area from like South Sandwich down kind of east of Mashpee-Wakeby Pond, over to Marston's Mills, and down to Kituit. That has been the swallow-tailed kite district for several years, and it's just been these scattered sightings from, April into July, where I can't quite piece together, not consistent enough in one place, no signs of nesting, but kind of suspicious because it's year after year. And then this year they settled in at Santuit Pond on the kind of Mashpee Barnstable line, and then people were seeing copulation, and people were seeing they're carrying nest sticks around, and nobody ever found the nest, but there were five of them. There were five swallowtail kites around Santuit Pond. I saw them myself one day. They were all in one tree. It just floored me. I mean, really, just one of the ornithological experiences. I've had many, but it just floored me. And again, no one found a nest, but they've been around. They've been around, and a lot of the sightings recently have been in Kitiut. And then over the last couple of days, somebody saw six together in the same tree at like a thrift shop by the Kitiut Center for the Arts, like a church, and all sitting in a tree and trying to figure out if any of those, because there used to be five and now there's six. So, did one of those fledge from a nest? And so I sent photos to a swallowtail kite expert that I know from when I met her when I worked in Florida, Gina Kent. And so she did her master's on them. She's put satellite tracking devices on them and tracked them to South America and monitored their nests and climbed trees. And so she'll know, if anyone will know, if any of these is a young bird, but I'm still trying to figure that out. But yeah, for the last few days, they've been down there sort of southeast of Santuit Pond and by the in more in Kitiut. And there's been a lot of sightings in different parts of Kitiut over the last couple of weeks. And then Mississippi kites are still around. They settled in Centerville in the yard of a birder, of all places.
How convenient.
Guy named Hans Holbrook, who has since moved to Chattanooga. But he was a gracious host for a while, and people were coming to his neighborhood and seeing these four, anyway, three, four Mississippi kites. And they were eating cicadas. So they're all taking advantage of the cicadas this year, and that should only increase the chances of them coming back again. And also that they successfully bred this year. There's no evidence that the Mississippi kites are breeding, despite the fact that like 15 years ago, Mississippi kites made this leap from, Louisiana, Oklahoma, Texas, Georgia, up to Connecticut and New Hampshire, somehow skipping Massachusetts. And so there have been nesting sites in Connecticut and a really well-known nesting site in the sort of Dover, Newmarket area in the New Hampshire Seacoast area for years in a suburban, like a roadside tree. And so I was like, years ago, I was like, well, it's just a matter of time. Maybe they're nesting already on the Cape, these Mississippi kites, but nothing. We've had nothing. And even this year, with all the Mississippi kites, there were four in South Plymouth near Great Herring Pond in a little kind of a conservation area no one had ever heard of, Whispering Pines or something like that. There were four Mississippi kites in there, again, eating cicadas, and then another three or four or more on the Mid Cape and in Centerville and Mashpee. And so it's just, this has really been the year of the kites. And it was a perfect year for them to hang out with the 17-year cicadas, just overwhelming, an overwhelmingly huge food source for anything that wanted it.
Do they stay through the winter or do they go off, migrate somewhere? Or do we know?
Oh, no, they go to South America.
They
These are
do, okay.
wimpy birds. Yeah, swallowtail kites. I used to work in the Everglades, and I would see them staging for migration in early August. They're like, ooh, getting chilly
Getting
around here in
chilly.
South Florida. I mean, it obviously wasn't getting chilly, but they want to be in South America for the winter, and they would make long flights down there to
So
winter
we
in
think these birds are
Brazil.
just
And
returning every year, right?
they're leaving for the winter, absolutely, and then they're coming back here from South America.
That's amazing.
In both cases, Mississippi kites are famously part of the they're both. So I did a hawk watch in Veracruz, Mexico, this famous River of Raptors hawk watch, where we counted 4.5 million hawks between late August and end of November. It's not, it's, I can't even describe
Super
it. It's
highway, yeah.
ridiculous. And most of those are broad-winged hawks, Swainson's hawks, and turkey vultures, but many, many thousands of other things. And the swallowtail kites migrate so early, they came through before we even started in late August.
Wow.
They've already passed through Mexico in late August on their way to South America. That's how afraid of getting a chill they are.
I didn't bring
And so,
my
yeah, the,
sweater.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, the is this air conditioning too cold for anyone else? And so, yeah, and then the miss, I remember looking up, I, my hawk watch, our hawk watch location, one of them was on some scaffolding in a soccer field in a little village in Mexico called Chichicoxtla. And I'm sitting there and it's kind of a boring day and it's hot. And I look up and I see 5,000 Mississippi kites.
Wow.
And that's what I knew what I had gotten myself into in this hawk counting gig in Mexico. And it was just like, I'd never seen anything
That's
like it.
amazing.
And so they come through fairly early. And then the Broadwing Hawks come and so on. So yeah, so
Yeah.
a very long way of saying they are certainly not here in the winter and they go all the way to South America.
Right. Got a couple of reports on hummingbird calls. Stephanie from East Falmouth reports none, zero. She and her neighbors normally get hummingbirds, but not this summer, at least so far. Dan also lives in East Falmouth and reports hummingbirds regularly visiting his feeder and flowers. So I guess they're
Well, that's
just,
good.
yeah. So they're there. They're just maybe not in your yard. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing them. I mean, we're at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary. We're, basically Northeast Ham. And we were just over the line into South Wellfleet from Northeast Ham. And, we certainly have them at our feeders. And the true test will be when the cardinal flower blooms on Silver Spring. If you get yourself to Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary a little bit later in the summer, go on the Silver Spring Trail, the sort of wooded trail that goes around the impounded pond. And look for the blooming cardinal flower, which in and of itself is just a spectacular living thing. I mean, that
It's
cardinal flower
gorgeous,
is one of
yeah.
my favorite wildflowers, and
So
it likes
pretty.
wet feet. So there are some areas along the banding, our net lanes that opened up some habitat for them. The clearing of the net lanes created habitat, and all this cardinal flower popped up because it had more sunlight. And the hummingbirds are just line up for that.
Yeah.
And at that time of year, later in summer, it's cardinal flower, and touch me not, or impatiens, or jewelweed is the most common name for it. Little yellow hanging, these little dangling, kind of vase-shaped flowers that bumblebees and hummingbirds love. And so when those things are blooming, they're all over the Silver Spring Trail there. But that'll tell us if there are any around.
Yeah, I think you should mention the different variety that people can see if they visit the sanctuary. I was thinking that. And there's a lot of really cool trails and different habitat, right? So talk a little bit about what folks who've never been to the sanctuary might find.
Yeah. excuse me. So you drive in through our pine woods where our campground is, and where our coyote pack is. We've got a couple of years ago we had the same thing. We had basically like a campground coyote pack. And I remember camping there and having them trotting by my tent at night, and the pups are around and they've grown up. The pups are looking more like adults all the time, but they've been just kind of around, and so you might actually see them at close range, and they're not really bothering anybody. So you come through the pine woods, and then you come to the visitor center. There's a big field, a big sand plain grassland with our bluebird boxes and our purple martin gourds, and our pollinator garden and our nature play area for kids and picnic area. But then there's tons of salt marsh. A lot of the sanctuary is in intertidal, so it's salt marsh. Our beach on Cape Cod Bay, looking across at Great Island, looking across Wellfleet Bay. There's the swampy, shrub swamps and swampy forests along Silver Spring. It's good for warblers in spring and fall. Shrublands, heathlands, coastal plain heathlands, which is a globally rare plant community with bearberry and Hudsonia and dwarf chinkapin oak. We even have weird oaks. People come and look, want to see our dwarf chinkapin oak, which is one of the scrub oaks. And so you kind of walk through that habitat. on the way out to the beach, where and that kind of shrubby open area that we maintain, otherwise it would turn into a forest. We keep that early successional for things like field sparrows and prairie warblers and bluebirds and towhees, and you can get all of those as you're walking out to our beach, and then the salt marsh, and then of course the bay. So yeah, a lot of different habitats. And we had piping plovers nest on our beach. You would think, oh, it's an Audubon sanctuary. You must have piping plovers nesting on the beach. Well, it's not much of a beach. It's a tiny little crescent beach. And this year, for the first time ever, we had piping plovers and roped it off. A coyote eventually got that nest. And
Bummer.
once you get into July, they can't re-nest anymore. They're done. But that was interesting. So, and yeah,
Well,
and the shorebirds are coming in now, and so it's getting good. And we have bird walks. We have morning bird walks. These 8 a.m. I'm actually leading one tomorrow. I just realized. I don't normally lead them, but I'm filling in and I'm leading the 8 a.m. bird walk
So there you
tomorrow
go.
at Wellfleet
That
Bay. It's probably full.
the sanctuary is Jackson's first birding excursion. He was 3 years
Oh.
old when we brought him through there to see where he the comment came, "I hope I see my best bird," which, as we know, is the robin.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard. I'll do a whole hike there and I'll be like, oh, I didn't get a robin. I got like 52 species, but I didn't get a robin.
Speaking of piping plovers, Hillary writes, "How are the piping plovers doing this season in general, and those specifically that nest just south of Nauset Public Beach? I worried about them during the big windstorm we had last week, and I noticed a large group of naturalists out there this morning. And P.S., have you noticed a bumblebee die-off this year, or just in our non-pesticide treated yard?" So let's start with the plovers.
Yeah, I'm less in touch because of some restructuring with what the crews are seeing. I know we do have a lot of fledged chicks in the sites that we manage. We being my, Wellfleet Bay has staff that cover sort of the Outer Cape, working through Mass Audubon's Coastal Waterbird Program that has sites from the North Shore to Truro and the islands and everything. And so they have a lot on their plates, but it's always mixed. And so there's a meeting. All the plover cooperators, including those from other states, come together at a meeting organized by Mass Wildlife in the first sometime the first week in August. And then we really know how they did because everybody reports in, and we have preliminary fledge data. But it's usually mixed. There was that storm in May, that nor'easter in May. That did a couple things. It wiped out a lot of nests, and it also killed horseshoe crab spawning. It's just, that's another one of my projects, and I was really hoping, because horseshoe crabs are now protected from all harvest from mid-April to the end of the first week in June, and so I was looking to see more numbers because it was the second year of that, and then this stupid nor'easter came
Oh,
in
man.
May and right at peak spawning and sort of wiped that out. But it also wiped out a lot of plover nests, which means that pushes them later into the season. What you want with piping plovers, especially if you're a beach manager where you have ORV driving, is you want them to nest early and be successful and fledge those chicks. And when that happens, they're done. The chicks are fledged by July 4th, and they don't impact beach season. But the ORV road is closed at Nauset Beach. They try to keep it open as much as possible. They have a plan in place that allows them some flexibility under the Endangered Species Act to keep it open and do certain things, babysit the chicks, make sure they're not in the trail and things like that. But it seems to be closed right now. And I think that's in part because of that storm pushing the nesting later. And so probably a lot of new chicks out there.
And what do you know about the bumblebee die-off? I have them in my yard.
Yeah, I don't know. There's not heard of a bumblebee die-off, but
Could be neighbors' pesticides. Yeah, she says hers is a non-pesticide treated yard, but maybe not the neighbors.
yeah, and that right. And if your neighbors are doing it, it drifts into your yard. They're not. I mean, the companies are. Sure, they're pushing. Like, they're supposed to. There are like regulations where they shouldn't be spraying if the wind is above a certain level. But no spray, no pay. So you can imagine. They're ignoring that a lot of the time, and so, but Yeah, I'm not aware of a short-term bumblebee die-off. Eastern bumblebees seem as abundant as always, but here's the thing: there should be 12 species of bumblebees, so
Right.
there is a long-term bumblebee die-off that has been happening for generations, for various reasons. And so, a lot of the species that used to be more common, and the average person just, oh, it's a bumblebee. They don't know that there are a bunch of different species. There are like three or four species that are still common. There's eastern bumblebee, brown belted, two spotted. I guess those are the three that are still fairly common. There's one with a fun name, the confusing bumblebee, that I see a lot at the sanctuary. They're all kind of confusing. But there are rusty patch bumblebee is now federally endangered, and the golden bumblebee. There are all these bumblebee species that are now quite rare. And for various reasons, pesticides have been implicated, diseases due to the domestication of bumblebees, because there are domesticated bumblebees as well. And so a lot of bumblebees are struggling, but I'm not aware of any kind of more acute short-term die-off.
All right. Good to know. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Linda is giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I'm calling just to respond to the previous caller about the bumblebees.
Sure.
I was very interested to note several years ago that the bumblebees, like the birds, love water in a bird bath. I mean, I have 50 or 100 bumblebees that will come, and I have a very shallow, rather small bird bath, and the bees are...
Well, yep. I think we just lost Linda. But
she's been attacked by a dog. Yeah.
No. All right. So, hey, that is an interesting point about the water. And I haven't seen bumblebees in my bird baths, but I was telling you, Mark, that this past weekend I was watering and filling my bird bath. And all of a sudden, because they really like the water, I had cardinals, blue jays, Baltimore Orioles, a nuthatch, flicker, a titmouse, and a sparrow. All kind of congregating where I was watering. And then I noticed a couple of them actually politely taking turns in the bird bath.
We should look to the birds. If only people were so polite.
I don't think the blue jay would have been quite so polite, but the other birds were being very polite. Yeah. Waiting for the one to be done and then flying down and taking his turn in the bird bath. But I imagine, yeah. Why wouldn't the bees like the water? So, yeah, that's a good observation by Linda.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of information regarding honeybees. Like everything else, honeybees just sort of suck up all the oxygen in the bee information world. But, yeah, I think they all need water. And, bee bowls, well, that's really sugar water. One way of surveying for bees that unfortunately involves them drowning is using these bee bowls to get to, you put them out, and otherwise it's very difficult to know what bees are in an area. Then you go back and collect them. They sort of drown in it. But yeah, if you find them drowned in things, and they were probably seeking water, but they shouldn't need a ton because they're drinking nectar. But that's interesting.
Yes. I wonder why.
It's not something I see very often.
Oh, we still have Linda. Linda, what did you say?
Mine are in
oh,
the
good.
Bird
The dog
bath,
released
and they
her.
do not drown.
Okay,
I
hers
mean, they are just like...
Hers are in the bird bath, and they don't drown. So she's got a shallow bird bath. Yeah,
right. Yeah, good.
Sometimes I see them in the pool. That's not a good thing. We try to scoop them out if they're still alive, but yeah.
Yeah. The only place I've ever been stung by a bee of any kind that I know of is in a pool. And it was, like a little sweat bee.
Yeah.
It just kind of like, it's a little pinch that you feel.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
All right. Maureen is calling from Nantucket. Hi, Maureen.
Good morning. First time caller, and I'm in what I would say is a opportunistic birder. Oh my gosh, look at that. I live in Matticat, the western end of the island, and right on Long Pond. And on Mattaquet Beach, the harbor beach, we saw what we first thought was an oyster catcher, you know, the bright orange mm-hmm. legs and beak. And then we realized when we looked at the book that it was a black skimmer with that, the top bill, you know, shorter than the, mm-hmm. the longer one. And nobody had remembered seeing one. Is that unusual? It looked like it might be unusual for here. So that's why I wanted to see.
Yeah. So the, yes, it is unusual. They're fun birds, and like everything else, like we talked about at the top of the show, everything's dispersing now. And so the only significant black skimmer nesting colony is near Edgartown on the Vineyard. And it's huge. Okay. I mean, given that there are none anywhere else in Massachusetts, basically, there's dozens of black skimmers nest on a beach on that part of the Vineyard. They don't nest on Monomoy. They don't nest in any Plymouth Beach. They don't nest in any other of these big colonies that we have. But they'll start dispersing. And so, you know, there are a couple at a place in Chatham recently. And so they could turn up anywhere now. And they're such a cool bird. Because like you mentioned, only bird in the world where the upper mandible is shorter. And they feed, they're sort of crepuscular, meaning dawn and dusk activity. And so they'll feed at dusk, and sometimes it's dark enough. You just see this kind of V moving across the water, a V of ripples moving across the water. And it's a skimmer going by with its lower mandible in the water, waiting to touch a fish, and then it snaps it, you know, just incredibly fast reaction time, snap shut that bill. Just such an odd little niche that they have, and their heads are weird. Like, everything about them is kind of funny. But you're right, it's the same basic color pattern of an oyster catcher, just like smooshed down. right, like if you ran one over, it's but yeah, that black on top, white underneath, bright red bill. Very cool birds.
Yeah, lucky you.
Thanks so much for finding out that there's this nearby colony, and maybe more of them will realize that, you know, there's a better island just a little ways away.
Always that competition, Maureen.
Shots fired.
Thanks for the call.
Shots fired.
Hey, enough for both islands. All right, let's talk to Tor, who's giving us a call. Hi, Tor.
Hi, Mindy. Hello there, Mark.
Hi, Tor.
Yeah, hi. Well, you're getting back to kites, although I've noticed that I think maybe the shortage of bees is the honeybee. But to talk about kites, feeding on cicadas, I did not see any kites at Crane Reserve when I was there, but I sure did see plenty of cicadas. But onto the kite, when I did have a opportunity to go to Ecuador and join the troop to go for butterflies, we happened to go to Machalia, and that was the home of the hook-billed kite, and I got one good picture of it before it took flight. It has a huge, very sharp D-curved bill. It's really remarkable, and a bright yellow iris. It was great to see it. I didn't have my digital camera then, but I did get a picture. It's a little grainy. I'll send it to you, but it's a nice occurrence that I didn't expect to see a hook-billed kite, but there it was.
Oh,
yeah,
sure.
The bill is for eating snails, as far as I remember, the tree snails. There's snail kites that you can see in Florida that eat the big apple snails in the Everglades. But then hook-billed kites, also, even though they live in forests, also eat big snails. I think they get out of the trees, if I'm remembering correctly.
Tor, thanks for sharing. One of the things I've noticed, a lot of, you know, people share their bird pictures a lot on Facebook, on some of those bird pages. I've seen a lot of people putting photos of green herons. Tell us a little bit. Are there more of them around now? Or, I mean, it's just, you know, people happen to...
They've been a species of concern. There's concern that they're declining. They're a little bit hard to monitor because they don't, you know, like herons and egrets tend to nest in big mixed colonies, big noisy, you know, if you know where they are, you just go into it and you count the nests, right? They're easy to monitor. But green herons, like yellow-crowned night herons, are two wading bird species that do their own thing. They don't join the big colonies. They nest by themselves in the woods somewhere. And there was a yellow crown. I'm getting off topic, but there was a yellow crown night heron nest in the Mid Cape somewhere this year that was just, I was looking in the tree it was in and I didn't see it. Like, that's how well hidden it was. It was just happenstance that anybody found it. And green herons do the same thing. It's about the size of a crow's nest, and it'll be in the woods near water somewhere. But just one of my favorite birds. I love green herons. You'll hear them a lot. They have this kind of loud call that they give when they take off or if they're disturbed. Cow. That wasn't bad. And they're little. They're the littlest of the herons around here. And if you get a good look at them in good light, there's that shimmery green and sort of maroon color, and they're beautiful little herons. They leave for the winter and go to Central America. But the lore of one of the fun facts about green herons is that they learn to fish. They will use bait to fish. And there are videos. This was, the early days of YouTube. There were videos of green herons just stationed at like a duck feeding pond, and they would pick up a piece of bread, put it down on the water to attract the fish to it, and then nail the fish. Like fishing, they're fishing with bait,
That is funny.
right? Right? It's not just the primates, right? It's not just the dolphins. Bird brain indeed. These green herons have learned to fish with bait.
Wow, it's
Uh,
funny.
but just fun birds, and they're certainly around, and we live in a place with lots of habitat for them, so we see green herons, but they are considered a declining species here in the state, of some conservation interest.
Yeah, so maybe we'll see more of them as we see people taking more pictures of them. Just got a
Yes.
couple of minutes left, so I thought maybe I'd touch on what's happening with the butterflies. I know you've got your garden there at the sanctuary. What are you seeing? I haven't seen any monarchs yet, but is it early or should they be here?
It is early. I saw my first one less than a week ago, sniffing around the increasing number of common milkweeds I have in my yard. I'm getting a little concerned.
Yeah,
It's like,
they'll take
what have I
over.
done? What have I done? I like left a pod on the railing of my deck one year, and now there's one growing. I'm like kicking it out of the way in my outside shower, and they're just, it's a sidewalk crack plant. You got to be careful with it. But the weird thing is, talking about the earliness of monarchs, I've only seen one, but then all of a sudden there's this big, beautiful butterfly weed, the orange flowered milkweed.
Love it.
Like if you're dropping off your kids at the camp at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary, it's right before the gate, and it's covered in big, ready to pupate monarch caterpillars. And I'm like, now wait a minute. Like, who laid those? I haven't seen a monarch until a week ago. And so those eggs must have been laid a month ago. How, like, did somebody raise them? Were somebody raising them in New Jersey, brought them on vacation, and then like put them on that plant when they were dropping off their
Oh,
kids? It's
interesting.
just it's suspicious. If anybody, it's too late to take more calls, but I would love to know, email me or something. Is anybody seeing monarch caterpillars already? Because I haven't really seen any monarchs, but it just takes one female getting around, and all of a sudden you've got caterpillars.
Well, I have a
The
ton
so
of that butterfly weed and the common butterfly weed, and I'm going to go check it all and see if we have any caterpillars.
Good for you. Just the Truro butterfly count, the North American Butterfly Association count that I lead. I meant to ask Tor if he was going to be there. He's always been a regular on that count. So that is Sunday at 9. We meet at the Highland Center up there in Truro, the golf course, and we kind of go around the edges and try not to get hit by somebody teeing off.
All right,
And then
well.
we go from there. But so that's the Truro butterfly count. And then the following Sunday, a week from this Sunday, is the Brewster count.
All
And we're
right.
trying to figure out where to meet. We usually
Gotta,
meet
I
at the
gotta
Museum of
cut you
Natural
off right
History.
there because we gotta meet the network.
All
Mark
right.
Verity, second Tuesday of the month. Thanks as always. I'm Indy
See you next
Todd.
time.
Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.